Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to open this ISEC seminar regarding prospects for the future in East Central Europe. May I first of all welcome you, the audience. It's a great pleasure to see you all here this evening. I'd also like to welcome our panel of speakers. We have a number of experts in the area and also commentators on the area. If I can just introduce them briefly by name now, I'll give you a little bit more about each of them as they stand up to speak. Have Professor Boone of the LSE, a lecturer in transition economics. I have Mr. Anthony Robinson, senior correspondent on Central and Eastern Europe with the Financial Times. Christopher Bowman, a senior advisor to the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And finally, with a certain pleasure, Stephanie Flanders from the Financial Times, who is an economic lead writer of the FT. Each speaker will speak for approximately 25 minutes. And what we'd like to do is invite some questions after each speaker. And then we should have some time at the end to have a general discussion about points raised. Ending should be about 9 o'clock. Without too much further ado, I'd like to hand over to Professor Boone.
Okay, thank you very much. It's great to be here, and ISEC is a wonderful organization, and I'm really honored to be invited to speak here. I was asked to give an overview of macroeconomic reform, which is obviously a huge topic, and what can you possibly say? Let me just say a couple things. It's been 11 years since Gorbachev came to power, 6 years since the reform started in Poland, 4 years since the reform started in the USSR. Amazing, because it really hasn't been that long. And yet, if you go to those countries, it's shocking, because there's just been massive change in all of them. If you look at the data, the private enterprise sectors have grown everywhere throughout the CIS and throughout Eastern Europe. Likewise, the service sector is growing very fast. You see, of course, industrial output declining in all the countries, but you see really substantial change everywhere you go. Even out in the boondoggles like Mongolia, which was probably one of the most isolated regions in the world, there are 11,000 new private enterprises in a country with only 2 million people. And for those people there, they used to think of Moscow as Paris, but now they actually travel to Paris. And if you go, the planes are packed, and it's really just a different lifestyle. It's just amazing how much change there's been in all these countries. And so the first lesson from the reforms here is that economic reform does work. Liberalization changes things dramatically. And you observe in all these countries just really shocking, fast, rapid change. For young people, it's just an incredibly exciting environment if you're starting out. Of course, there are distributional issues, and I'm sure other people will come on to them, but it's really a massive change. Today, we see in Albania, believe it or not, Albania growing at 6% a year. We see Estonia growing at 6%, Poland growing at 7%, Czech at 4%, Mongolia at 6%, Slovakia at 5%. All these countries are growing faster than most countries in Europe. It's really a change, and we're seeing, and hopefully we'll see in the future, convergence of these countries. So the first result has been countries that do rapid reform, respond rapidly, change rapidly. Homo Sovieticus never existed. It was an awful term from the start, and we really see a big change, and it's terrific to see the change. So is this everything? Is that all we've learned then, that you'd want to go ahead and do things rapidly? And the answer to that is no. And the reason the answer is no is because it's much more complicated. When you looked at what happened in these countries, we made a lot of mistakes in policy advice and policy reform. And thinking back on it, it's worthwhile to understand what mistakes we made, because it will be useful for the future. But it's also going to tell us what the future is for these countries, I think, at least in terms of the economics. So what was the big issue? Well, let's think about what I want to call anarchy and rent-seeking. Let's look at what happened at the start of these countries, or at the start of reforms, and particularly I want to think about the CIS and Russia. When the reform started in these countries, there was enormous fighting. You have to remember, the parliament and the Duma in Russia in those first few years were constantly fighting the reformers. When Hasbulatov, the Speaker of the Parliament, found out that Gaidar was appointed prime minister, he didn't go to him and say, let's compromise. He said, you guys, you're wearing pink shorts and yellow boots. We want to see you out. You know, it was really just a very confrontational environment from the very beginning. The Gaidar team, when they came into power in Russia, thought they would lose power in a couple months. It was just a very fragile environment. And month by month, we saw in that country the tension grow. If you look around at the other countries, it was similar. In Ukraine, there was a fight going on between the president and the parliament. In Kyrgyzstan, where the president was trying to reform, the parliament was fighting against him. In Mongolia, likewise, you see it across all these countries, this tension and this battle at the very top. And then what's the end result of that? Well, of course, economic policies go awry. You saw very high inflation in these countries. You saw them introduce all sorts of decrees which contradicted each other. You saw reversals of policy reform time and time again. It was really just an explosion. And we saw it all documented. It was documented for us in the Financial Times. It was documented everywhere, time after time, in the headlines. Russian reforms about to reverse, things in crisis, etc. And we wondered what would happen. Well, in the end, there was an explosion, of course, and the explosion was the bombs flying into the parliament. The Duma collapsed. There was a brief window of opportunity for some reforms at that point, and then it went back to a battle. But the battle is gradually dying down. Now, what was going on in all of this? And I want to repeat, this happened in a lot of countries, not just in Russia. And the answer is it really was anarchic. When you start with a political system based on a single party that has power, and then suddenly that party collapses, it's obvious that there's a political vacuum. In most countries, you have a clear way of choosing the leader. You have a clear way of choosing, or you have rights and wrongs. You have penalties imposed on people who sort of deviate from what is considered to be good for society when they're in leadership. Those penalties may be stronger, they may be weak, but what was characteristic of all these countries was that there was virtually an absence of penalties in them. I was at a conference a little while ago where Boris Fyodorov was speaking, and he said, let me tell you, you know, he said in a Russian accent, I can't say it, he said, basically, there's no crime in Russia. And everybody looked at him and said, you've got to be crazy. And he said, no, there's no crime whatsoever in Russia. And we said, what do you mean there's no crime in Russia? He said, look at the statistics, there's no crime. The point he was trying to make was that there is no crime in the statistics because there's no enforcement of penalties. And so if you have no enforcement of penalties, you don't get it recorded, nobody goes to jail, there's no crime, of course. But there is crime, enormous crime, because there are no penalties. And so one of the issues then was that there was leadership that sometimes inherited power, that somehow came into power some bizarre way. There were people that had no checks and balances of them in government. And that gives you opportunity either for great rent-seeking and corruption, or it gives you opportunity to be a real good leader and to try to cause reform and change. And so we observe two different types of countries, really. This is obviously an oversimplification, but it's a way of thinking about how these reforms have gone and what you have to do. Well, what happens when you get into power in that sort of situation? It's obvious, you grab what you can if you're corrupt or if you're trying to get rents or you're rent seeking. And just to show you why it was so difficult to stop it, let's think about the numbers. In Russia in 1992, they issued money equal to 32% of GNP. That's one third of the total income of the country. Historically, that's unprecedented. Nowhere in the world has that amount of money been issued. Why issue it? Because it's so simple. It's an easy way to get power. It's an easy way to buy resources from other people. It's simple. If you're in charge of the central bank or you're the parliament and you can call up the central bank chief and get him to do it, why not? There are no penalties, nothing, so you may as well try. You saw this going on to an enormous extent in the first year and in the second year. Likewise, rents from natural resources are another easy thing to grasp when there's a battle going on for resources. Russia has roughly $25 billion of exports every year of natural resources. It's very cheap to produce oil, so most of that is profit, or a large part, once you've already dug the wells, etc. What it means, again, is that if everybody's going to fight over those resources, if you threw a bunch of money up on the stage, everybody would run up and try to grab it, right? And that's the type of thing that's going on. People are out there trying to grab these resources. Another example, bilateral credits given by the West to Russia in 1992, $12.5 billion. Went to the Ministry of Finance, or I'm sorry, the equipment was shipped to the enterprises. It was the Ministry of Finance job to collect that money from the enterprises. Guess how much they collect? 2% of the total value. Of course, the Russian government's left with the debt. The Russian taxpayers have to pay the debt in the future. But again, money that's just disappeared in the economy. It's a fight over resources. The last example of this, and the most extreme, is property. and the state enterprises, et cetera, the natural resources, all this wealth, you know, make guesses at what it's worth, but a reasonable calculation would put it at somewhere around $600 billion. Of course, if $600 billion is available, people are going to fight over it very, very hard. And that's what you see, fighting over the privatization program, fighting over who gets control of enterprises. Right up today, we constantly see this battle in the newspaper. It's really like thinking of sort of a giant honeypot. It exists. If you have somebody who's trying to stop people from grabbing it, they have to be extremely strong. It's very hard even to imagine when you think about it, Yeltsin standing up in front of this. You know, he'd have to be very healthy, of course, and be able to stop this type of grasping of resources. And so it was just really an extreme situation, which is in many ways unprecedented in history, but you could think about it as happening after wartime. You can think about it as happening after other periods. But it's no wonder that the liberal leaders had so much trouble carrying out reform. Well, what's the end result? In those countries where you had this type of rent-seeking, you had two types of things going on. One is they were issuing lots of money, and the other thing they were doing is trying to grasp the resources and other things that they could grasp. The easiest way to grasp natural resources is to put on export restrictions on trade, quotas, licenses, et cetera. Believe it or not, every country has the gamut of them in the CIS. Lots of licenses, lots of export restrictions. Go to the cotton-rich countries like Turkmenistan, you'll find the president controls all the exports of cotton. It goes right up to the top. Just like in Iraq, all the exports of oil are controlled by the president. It's just a natural political outcome. But the end result, when you look at the impact for countries, and we try to think about why it is some of them did reforms, which they did and others didn't, is the following simple graph. On the vertical axis, there's a measure by the World Bank of what's called liberalization. And it's the amount the countries have liberalized their economies, got rid of the export restrictions, got rid of trade quotas, liberalized their currencies, so you have mobility of capital, et cetera. That's measured on the vertical axis. On the horizontal axis is inflation. What you observe is that countries are either basically up there in the top left, and those are countries with low inflation, lots of liberalization. Those are the ones that have broken this anarchic fight that I was describing. They no longer have this grasping of resources. And then in the bottom right, you have the countries that are really having high inflation. They're imposing all sorts of restrictions on trade. They're doing everything possible to get these resources. And those are mostly CIS countries. But this correlation... Sure. If you can't see it, it's not that important. This is Ukraine. This is Georgia, which is in war. Uzbekistan is over here, high inflation. Russia is here. And then up here we have Hungary, Czech, Slovakia, Poland must be somewhere there. The countries which have low inflation and liberalized. But the point is, gradualism, as it's called sometimes in the papers, as it's called sometimes in the media, does not mean trying to help out people and help out the poor. What it means is actually trying to grasp resources when we observe it. These countries with high inflation who are not cutting credits are simply not cutting this rent seeking and this grasp for resources. Just to emphasize how strong that is, I told you at the start, Russia issued 32.7% of GNP in money at the start of the year. It would cost about 2 to 3% of GNP to have a really good social program in the country. Why issue 32? It's totally ridiculous. It's obvious there's another reason behind it, and that's what's going on in these countries. So reform is trying to end that sort of rent-seeking and that sort of corruption. And then in 1993, if you remember, after the elections and the Gaidar team lost, Strop Talbot, the representative from the Clinton administration for Russia, came to Moscow and he said, gee, there's been too much shock and too little therapy. Okay, and the reformers got extremely angry because they were fighting against this. And this is really the way it's operating in a lot of these countries. So what's the implication of this when you have this sort of scramble for resources at the start of reform? Well, the good side is that there's great scope for leadership. And the reason there's great scope is because, again, everybody has the opportunity to do something. At the start of reform, the problem you run into is that there's some very strong interest groups who are fighting you and who don't want you to carry through. In particular, these are the directors of enterprises, the old enterprise elite that's really lived off the credits and is in trouble, many of the industrial enterprises, if the credits are cut, because they need it badly in order to survive. But then there's also a standard group like the coal mines, agricultural cooperatives. The most simple example in the news recently is chicken farms. The Russian chicken farms, unfortunately, are just not competitive in world markets. Chickens aren't very good. They're very high priced. They really should go bankrupt. But the problem is the chickens exist. And since the chickens exist, there are people fighting to get subsidies to keep them alive. And so you find, at least until, you know, and so you find what's happening is that there's subsidies coming in time and time again to the chicken farm. The chicken farmers get together and lobby the government. The government gets together and imposes a trade restriction on chickens, and that adds to the trade restrictions in the economy. And this battle continues on. The optimistic side of it is that if you break these various interest groups that are fighting the reform, you can break it permanently. And the idea is that once the chicken farm disappears, there won't be any more chickens and nobody will lobby for them. And it goes all the way up to the bigger enterprises. If you cut back on the credits, what you observe is that their output falls in those enterprises, but we also observe enormous labor market mobility in Russia, people moving very often, the private sector growing fast, as I said. So a whole new set of interest groups arises in the private sector and outside of the sector. And so in the end, you no longer have the interest groups that were lobbying credit for credits before existing. And so you find that the reforms actually aren't reversed once they're done. If you get into the reform and you start it and you keep it going, it actually stays. And so you end up in a situation where the reforms are lasting. And this is the positive side because it's very different from Latin America. In Latin America, we see these populist cycles where you see inflation after inflation after inflation. In these countries, it doesn't look like it will happen because once you enter into the reforms, you break the group that was fighting for the inflation before. So what does this mean then? Well, the implication of all of this with sort of reform actually working in these economies and with the need to really stop this harmful and socially costly seeking of rents in society, it means you'd really want to get a leader in who really does things very quickly, breaks the elite by cutting their credits, who gets in and stops, refuses to impose trade restrictions, et cetera, stops supporting all these various groups, and that will actually weaken those groups that are trying to stop the reform. So we have Balcerovich in Poland, we have Akayev in Kyrgyzstan, we have Klaus in the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia formerly, we have Matlar in Estonia, there's also Albania and other countries, all sorts of countries where a leader happened to come in who really wanted to carry out the reform and did it. Now, you might say to me, aha, here's the problem. Everyone you mentioned, except Klaus, is now out of power. And the answer, of course, is that's very true. He's out of power. But the question you really want to ask is, does it lead to a reversal of reforms and going back? And the answer is, of course, it doesn't really lead to a reversal of reforms. All the countries I listed that went radically didn't reverse. They lost, some of their leaders left, some of them didn't, but they didn't reverse. But let me make a second point. You have to look carefully at this question. We read it all the time. If you go radically, it's dangerous socially. There'll be a social explosion. And so the question is it true? And the answer to that is quite surprising, I find. First of all, there's three ways to look at it. I want to look at elections and opinion polls to try to answer the question. In a paper with Anders Oslin and Simon Johnson, what we did this, and basically, the first thing we did was look at countries that entered into radical reforms and then subsequently had elections. And we asked the question, did the countries that entered into radical reforms find their government lost power in the subsequent election? 4 out of 6 cases, the answer is no. Only in 2 cases did they lose. In the cases they lose, like Poland, it's not because people voted against reform, it's because the opposite or the reformists were divided. Solidarity broke up, and you saw a lot of small parties in the group. The second question then, so first of all, it doesn't seem like you lose elections if you enter into radical reform. If you were gradual in the 2 cases we looked at, you lost the elections. So you had at least a bigger chance of not than the other side. The second question was, what about post-communist parties coming to power? Because we observe them coming to power in a lot of places. When you look at what's actually happening, they do come to power, but it's not because they have 51% of the vote. Usually they have 30, 35, 38, something like that. It's actually a small fraction. The opposition vote is as big or bigger very often. But the point being, the opposition, again, is always divided. The Communist Party has maintained its machinery. It's one solid block like Zhuganov on the left in Russia. And they're fighting. And they get all the votes together. So they do well in parliamentary elections. Hopefully they do less well in presidential elections. The third point is to just look at opinion polls. And there's an opinion poll. There's a whole bunch published by Eurobarometer. But let me show you one particular one here. the questions on this poll are, do you think reforms are going too slow? Do you think they're going too fast? Or and then it compares the difference of the two, and it's over some 15 or 13 countries. And again, you won't be able to read this, but the but you have to believe me, which is the great part about it. Don't look. And here we have too slow, here we have too fast, and here we have the difference. And going all the way down, Poland, 36% think it's too slow. The Czech Republic, 2%. Well, close is there. Slovakia, 51%. Estonia, 39%. These are rapidly reforming. Russia, 41%. Romania, 43%. Belarus, 59%. Ukraine, 53%. Kazakhstan, 45%. There, all these countries really show a desire to go faster with the reforms. And the point being, what people are concerned about is not the speed of reform, really. What they're concerned about is getting security and getting back to a situation of stability. And they feel this is returning too slowly. And the way to return to stability is very clear. You move through the reforms fairly quickly. You develop clear property markets. You develop clear economic markets, et cetera. And we see countries stabilize and start to grow again. And that's what people are asking for in all of these things. So finally, let me just reiterate. The public opinion polls don't show people wanting to go more slowly. The election results don't show it. And even when the leaders are kicked out of power, the reforms aren't reversed. When you launch these reforms, they generally don't get reversed. And I've argued that it's because of this political change in political power. So then what's the implication? What have we learned about reforms? And the first point is that at the very start, you have to recognize this is a fight for resources, and you have to break this fight at the very start. And so Anders Odland, his first comment is to what you have to do is a grandiose strategy, but he argues that it's really institute political democracy. And the argument being that democracy puts checks and balances on the leadership. And we see it today in the Russian elections. Finally, somebody's doing something about pensions and about wage arrears. They could have done it 2 years ago. They could have done it 1 year ago. They're finally doing it now. Why now? Because the elections are coming. Likewise, corruption. Enormous corruption a year ago, even 8 months ago in this shares for loan scheme. Now it's all out in the air. It's much more dangerous to enter into it. You can be sure there won't be a shares for loan scheme coming up around the elections. So these type of things are important, and democracy helps leaders, guide leaders. And he makes the very strong argument, and it seems very correct, that you want to have really try to encourage political reform as part of any set of policy measures. And it should be done right at the start so that leaders have the chance to operate. They aren't like Gaidar, constantly being attacked right from the very first day they begin. The second point is that in the midst of chaos, even when you're in Gaidar's situation, we've actually learned some interesting things that are possible to help make reforms irreversible. I want to make an analogy to what are called poison pills in corporate finance. The first example of this is privatization. If you distribute assets to everybody, of course, they have an interest in holding on to those assets. And so if you tell them then, well, I want to renationalize it now because I've got to reverse everything, they'll, of course, be very angry. Zhuganov says recently he will not renationalize because he knows there will be blood in the country. And so to the extent that Chubais is responsible for getting this through early, he's done a really major service to the Russian economy because he's forced Zhuganov to recognize private property, something that he might not have wanted to do otherwise, given what we hear him say. The second example of these type of things comes actually from Mongolia. It's very interesting. In Mongolia, as I said, very remote country out in the middle of nowhere, they started the reforms with nobody really knowing what to do. There was a small group that wanted to go radically. There was a small group that wanted to do China. There was a small group that wanted to do other things. They had enormous bad initial conditions. The one thing they did do was introduce democratic reform and introduce autonomy for enterprises and introduce the free right for private business. And this in itself is like a poison pill. The moment you do that, the enterprises say, I'm not going to listen to your state orders anymore, and I'm not going to listen to your control of prices anymore, because I don't have to, because I can do something else. The private enterprises go out to the farms. They have a lot of sheep there, and they go out and they buy the sheep. And so the sheep don't show up at the five big state slaughterhouses. They just disappear.
And so the end result is that it's no longer possible to control the economy like it was before. And so you saw in Mongolia, over a period of 2 years, they just gradually gave up on control after control with some urging from the IMF. And by the end of 2 years, they're one of the most liberal economies in the world. The reason, again, was the starting of these legal and constitutional freedoms that changed everything in the country. So once you start the ball rolling, it's very hard to stop. A third example of ways that people have achieved something is making strikes and sort of doing something and making it when you have the opportunity, these windows of opportunity. When the parliament was shelled in Russia, Fyodorov was working in the Ministry of Finance, and he immediately wrote a number of decrees which called for the abolishment of a lot of agricultural subsidies. Those subsidies were subsequently abolished before the election. There was really a vacuum of power. And the end result was they've never been returned. It had been extremely difficult up to that point to do it. And so again, if you make these strikes, you sometimes can't do reforms all in a package like people want or the IMF wants. But you can do things one at one, and you want to find out things which are irreversible. And it's an interesting area for economic theory, which we really haven't looked at all. Other things you'd want to do is, of course, define the budget process clearly, have penalties on the parliament if they don't pass your budget, all sorts of other things to stop the fighting for resources that's going on in the economy. Well, finally, let me then ask the question, where are we going? If you believe this sort of anarchic and rent-seeking view of the world, then what's going on? Well, the first thing I would say is you have to recognize when you read the newspapers that all these bizarre fights represent extreme entrepreneurial spirit. If you look, for example, in Norilsk Nickel, the managers of Norilsk Nickel are fighting right now in Russia, or they were, they lost. They were fighting to get control of their enterprise against the interests of the shareholders of the enterprise. It's very clear why. They're one of the biggest producers of nickel in the world. It's a very valuable company. Why not fight and try to get the resources? That's entrepreneurial spirit if I've ever heard of it. Of course, if I were director of the enterprise, that would be how I'd put my energies. I'd want to get control of the enterprise. And so it seems like a bizarre fight on the outside, but it's a natural fight. It's fighting for resources. Likewise, the explosion of banks in Russia reflects fighting for resources. There are 2,500 of them. Some of them are bound to go bankrupt. It was a simple way of transferring resources out of the enterprise to somebody else, and it looked legal. You opened up a bank, put your money in the bank, and it lent on to somebody else, and so you had a big creation of banks. So what? Finally, let me point out another aspect of the current issues. It's actually a lesson. The voucher program in some ways has turned out to be a mistake. And the reason is, in Russia, everybody was given a voucher. What happened in the end was that insiders got a lot of control of the enterprises. And so what we see within the enterprises then is that the directors, they've already got some control, they've got the shares of the enterprise, there's no outside shareholder group that's being able to get at them and organize. And so now they're trying to get up the rest of the shares as easily as they can. So we read again in the newspapers that there are no share registries. Of course there aren't any, because the director wants to get hold of the shares. We read that they put the share registry up in the middle of northern Siberia, and you have to fly there if you want to buy a share and register the share. Okay, it's clear, you know, you want to get hold of the enterprise. They hide information. They have obviously enormous incentives to disobey the law. They are fighting, like Norilsk Nickel, the idea of corporate governance time after time after time. And as we watch this happen, of course, we say, my God, it must be chaos. But is this really dangerous, or is something happening that's good? And the answer is actually, I'm quite optimistic because it looks quite good at the moment. What we do see is lots of enterprises all of a sudden making their shareholder registries. We see them issuing ADRs. We see enterprise after enterprise turning around. Surgut Neftgaz just recently did it. Very harsh on outside shareholders, decided all of a sudden to be very good to them. Why? Because they realize it's in their incentive to be good to them. Why? Because, first of all, they own more of the shares now, and so they're the shareholders, and they'd like to see the shares have value. And secondly, because they're seeing the laws gradually change. And so this type of process, it's incredibly unfair, and it's sad in a sense, because the average Russian got a voucher, and it was a lousy voucher and didn't turn out to be worth very much. But the end result of all of this is that the vouchers are going to be concentrated in enterprise managers and directors and some workers' hands over time, and then those people are going to want to see laws enforced, and they're going to want to see this anarchy end. Likewise, the elections are helping with that. So gradually, we see on all fronts, I think, an improvement which is moving in the right direction. Now, yeah, just one more minute. Now, let me just finish off with my last half minute. There's obviously one question hanging over all this, and that's the elections and political earthquakes, like someone was talking about the death of Yeltsin. Luckily, Stephanie Flanders is here, and so she's going to talk about that, and I'll leave it aside. I have no idea. And then the last thing I would point out then is that really it is entrepreneurial spirit we're observing in Russia, and we're observing enormous change. And to the extent that these property rights do get consolidated in the near while, then I think we can be very optimistic, and it's going to be a great environment in those countries in the future, hopefully. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Peter. I think it was a pretty tough job to be asked to cover about a quarter of the world's landmass, 480 million people, and the last 70 years in 25 minutes. You did an admirable job. Thank you. I'd like to have the opportunity to invite some questions from the audience. So if there is anyone who'd like to come along with a question, we can get a few in. Please, lady at the back. Would you feel more comfortable coming up? Do we have microphones or we have portables?
Yeah, can I just say we have microphone upstairs as well?
So, hi.
So. All right, thank you.
Okay. Yes, really, I've just got two questions that are really a little bit of a note of caution to what was spoken about. The first question really goes to about the growth figures, because and relates to that opinion poll that you put up. Because the way I see it is that if, for example, Poland, which is leading the growth, actually continues its growth as it is at the moment, then I think is it 1997, 98, then it'll actually return to the 98 figures of growth. And does that not... And I mean, once you take into account that 1989 was actually after decades of stagnation, is that not a problem? And also, for the other countries, like Hungary, if it continues its growth rate at present, then it's going to be sort of at the end of the century that it will be back to the base of 1989. Now, that's just a note of caution, and I wonder whether or not that actually influences the opinion poll that we saw, where we saw that in terms of the reforms being too slow, that actually that's a reflection of the fact that the reforms are taking a long time to actually... enable recovery to back to that level before, and that actually that would have an effect in terms of external trade. The other question that is, again, a note of caution is in terms of the level of internal debt that is actually particularly in the Visegrad countries at the moment, and the effect that that might have on the banking system and the possibility of macroeconomic instability from that. Those are basically it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. On the first question...
summarize those.
Yeah.
Like two elements in there, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Now I've got five more minutes here. No. The first question on the growth, like obviously you have to be very cautious with the growth numbers. Poland just revised its growth numbers and said it fell by 7% in 1990, and it actually grew by 1% in 91, according to their official statistic agency. So they're way above their previous level, if those numbers are correct. And obviously, in other countries, it's true, but you know all the problems. These initial data are really just wrong, and what we want to see is rapid growth in these countries so they converge over time, and that will depend on other things. But I don't think we need to look to the past to try to compare. It's the future we want to really think about on those. On the internal debt, a lot of countries in the world have these problems of banks with large internal debts. It's a technically solvable problem that can be done at fairly low cost to the budget if you do it correctly. So I wouldn't even worry about that. The bigger problem is restructuring the banking sector so it's got good incentives in the future to really make loans efficiently.
Further questions? Gentleman in the red at the back.
I wonder if you could comment on the sort of compare the Chinese reform process with the sort of Soviet reform process, and sort of consider the relative merits of the two, relative success of the two.
Okay, that's obviously a huge question too. let me say particular thing. One, the economies are completely different from the start. I don't think it's fair to compare these apples and oranges. Really. China has 70% of the labor force in agriculture, if you free up peasant agriculture that's highly inefficient, you get fairly rapid growth at the start. Secondly, China had very little state control of the economy. The number of prices fixed, enterprises controlled, et cetera, was much smaller. So if you had rapid growth in the agricultural sector, you can support a state sector that's relatively inefficient over time. So they could grow fast. Thirdly, to compare, it's very interesting to look at Vietnam versus China, similar countries. Vietnam went through a very rapid reform in 86, stabilized their economy, liberalized everything. The result was that they grew very fast, 10% a year subsequently. It looks just like China. The reform was very different. So I think it's really the structure of the economy. I guess the last point to bring out is that the control of enterprises in Russia and China was very different. China was decentralized, and there was competition across regions, you could argue. In Russia, it was very centralized, and they're big, large enterprises, and they employed 80% of the population. So it's just different things.
Thank you. Okay. I'd now like to move on to Mr. Anthony Robinson, senior correspondent of the Financial Times. He tells me he's an LSE graduate. He's also the East European editor for the FT and was Moscow correspondent, but left rather rapidly for reasons which do appear in the press occasionally. Anthony, can I pass on to you?
Thanks very much. Well, I'd like to start by saying what a pleasure it is to be back here. When I was here, Mick Jagger was studying sociology. Mick Jagger doesn't describe himself as a sociologist, and even though I've got a first degree in economics, that certainly doesn't make me an economist. What I am is a journalist, and the definition of journalism which I like best is the one which says a journalist is somebody who knows nothing and explains everything. I'd like to start off with a quote from somebody who is also masquerading somewhat, and that was Jacques Attali, who's we have our colleague here from the EBRD, and I hope he won't object. Jacques Attali, who was in many ways a very interesting man and came out with some marvelous one-liners. And one of them was when he was under a lot of criticism for being head of the glistening bank that you probably remember. He said, but how do you can't judge the performance of a jet plane by its height and speed on takeoff. And I must say that struck me as being a fairly effective defense for the EBRD, which was being accused of all sorts of things at the time, having only been started about 9 months earlier. And I think that it also helps to explain what is happening, or what are the prospects, rather, for trade and investment and capital flows in the former communist world. Because what I think is happening is a sort of flywheel effect. There was, of course, a period of euphoria right at the beginning, but that was largely a reflection of the enormous ignorance about the part of the world which was one of the great economic backwaters, the Soviet Empire, and was indeed a rather unknown part of the world. In fact, it was a very unknown part of the world. Not only was it unknown, but what we were told about it was a complete lie, or most of it. For pointing out which, I did, as the chairman mentioned, got thrown out of the Soviet Union in 1983. So let's have a look at this flywheel that is now in operation. The economics of reconstruction, which were a very inexact science in 1989 and 1990, the question posed then was essentially how on earth do you create capitalism without capital? And under the circumstances, they've done extremely well. But the first stage, which all these countries passed through, was a period of what I call constructive destruction. Now, these economies, the Soviet model economy, was never designed to increase the wealth, health, and happiness of the people of the Soviet Empire. It was designed to increase the strength and power of the Soviet state. And that was interpreted increasingly and almost exclusively towards the end by their gerontocratic leaders. in military terms. And so you had the resources of a vast empire devoted primarily to trying to keep up with the Americans and producing vast amounts of guns, tanks and planes and the iron and steel and all the other things which were required to back that up. Well, what they didn't ever manage to produce was a decent shirt or a decent pair of trousers. And once that empire collapsed, you had a huge swathes of the economy which were revealed as being of no use to man or beast. And so you had right at the beginning a period where entire cities suddenly lost their raison d'etre. You had entire industries which also suddenly had no reason for being there. And you had a pattern of trade which was also revealed to be nonsense, deliberately nonsense, because, as I mentioned earlier, there was nothing economic about it. All the flows of capital, the flows of trade and so on, were all designed essentially with political purposes in mind. Because there's no rational explanation for having, for example, the sole factory for producing cigarette filters in Azerbaijan and the sole cigarette machine producing factory in Lithuania, and then another factory somewhere else which was the only one that produced paper and so on and so forth. The reason, the purpose of this was to make every part of the Soviet Empire dependent on every other part, and in that it really did. The Soviet system worked rather well. But when it came to reconstructing the economies of this part of the world on market lines, then suddenly you found that all the principles upon which the Soviet economy were based were revealed to be anti-economic, irrational, and so on and so forth. So first, you had a huge collapse in production, not quite as huge as we heard in reply to the questioner, not quite as huge as appeared, because the statistics were heavily geared towards the results of the state factories, and in any case, the statistics were always cooked in the first place. It's not that, you know, you could believe what was happening until 1989. You couldn't believe anything these people said. I mean, the whole Soviet system was a system where lying was perfectly reasonable behavior, and in fact was what they did all the time, on the economy, on politics, on arms control, you name it. Now, so that was the beginning. We had a destructive period which actually led to an increase in real income which was not picked up by any of the statistics. Because if you stop turning oil, iron ore, and all the raw materials of a vast empire into pollution, or shipping it to people who don't want it, or producing it for warehouses which are bulging at the seams, and actually even steal the military stockpiles and export them and put the money in the foreign exchange account, you can still have a net gain in people's standard of living. And that is in fact what happened. $50 to $60 billion, they're not my figures, they're figures from the International Institute of Finance, I think it's called, and taken from the BIS and the banks reporting to the BIS, something like $50 to $60 billion flowed out of the Soviet Union in that period, 1989-1991. Now, what that represented essentially was the liquidation not only of the military stockpiles, but primarily the military stockpiles, and they went out in military trains to ports which were still controlled by the military. And I remember speaking to the harbour master in Tallinn, who was telling me, the trains come in the middle of the night from somewhere in the Soviet Union, we don't know where, there's no control on any of the borders, they go to the military wing of the port, and ships come in into the night, they're loaded, and off they go, and that's the last we see of them. Well, those $50 to $60 billion, plus the money which has come from various Western aid and governments and so on and so forth over the years, large amounts of that money have in fact gone out of the Soviet Union in that way. Now, and yet, when you go to the Soviet Union, it's quite clear that they live much, much better now. Most people there in the Soviet Union live much better now than they did before. You can go over the, you can go to the former Soviet Union. You can find goods which were not available in the people's wildest imagination before. And if you look at the figures, it is quite clear that they're nonsense. You talk about, you know, annual income of $300 or whatever it is. Well, I wish I could live as well as that on $300. And that's more or less, you know, wherever you go in this part of the world, quite clearly these figures are nonsense when it comes to purchasing power and everything else. So one has got to be very, very careful about figures in this part of the world. And that $50 or $60 billion is a very important figure. You're going to get the lowdown on the former Soviet economy from Stephanie, so I would I'll just linger just very briefly on this. The question that the future shape of the former Soviet economy is going to depend not dramatically. I think in general one has to say that the main fount of investment and investment funds has got to be domestically generated savings, as it is in any other country in the world. Foreign investment is always going to play a fairly marginal part, although given the technological gaps between the normal Western-style economy and the Soviet-style economies, there are huge productivity gains to be made, and that is one of the principal sources of future savings, future capital accumulation, and future growth. That is the main source, not foreign investment. But to return to the $50 to $60 billion, that will return to the former Soviet Union, to Russia in particular, once the macroeconomic stability has been re-established, once the people who are the new owners of this wealth feel confident that it will not be taken away from them as they took it away from others. And at that point, it will return into the former Soviet Union, and mainly Russia, in the form of foreign investment, because that's, of course, will not come in under the name of Colonel Ivanov. It will come in under the name of Herr somebody or other, or Monsieur somebody else. Now, we started off then with a period of constructive destruction, and as has already been mentioned, that period began to end about 1991 and 1992, and it ended first in Poland, which, again, as we mentioned, was the first country to embark upon what has become known as shock therapy. Well, enough has been said and written about shock therapy. I don't want to add to it. I'm sure you're familiar with all the arguments. But suffice it to say that if you read the latest transition update of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, a document which I highly recommend because it really is an extremely interesting document, and above all, it's a very optimistic document, because the main thesis of this year's report is that many countries in the former Soviet bloc, starting with the countries of Central Europe, who were always the fastest off the starting block, and were in any case historically and traditionally the more advanced countries. In fact, they never were in the Russian sphere of influence before. Russia only became a great power, with a world power at least, with the destruction of German power in Europe, and that was always going to be a temporary phenomenon. So the Soviet occupation or Russian domination of Central Europe was, historically at least, doomed. What we didn't know ever was whether the Russians were going to leave peacefully or whether it was going to take World War III to get them out, and that had the terrible risk of possibly frying us all. Fortunately, it didn't work out that way. So the countries of Central Europe, led by Poland, began the return to economic growth, and that return to economic growth has been very much trade orientated. The collapse of trade with Comecon, that irrational trade with Comecon, was complete and rapid. Everybody, it was terribly, terribly painful at the time. But I think one of the lessons of the last 5 years has been the quicker you do it, the better it is. It's a bit like pulling a bandage off a wound. If you pull it off hair by hair, it hurts like hell. If you pull it off quickly, you hardly notice it. And I think that more or less is the lesson to be learnt from Central Europe. And it's a lesson which, again, is demonstrated, it seems, in Russia and Ukraine and Belarus and countries like that, which started on reform, which retreated, which went forward again. The longer, the more drawn out it is, the more painful it is. Because the important thing is you do have to establish macroeconomic stability and a legal and institutional framework if you are going to get the kind of investment and the kind of confidence, above all, that you need to get any economy going. Now, the Central Europeans, as I say, were the first to re-establish that macroeconomic stability, and they were then the first to become the recipients of foreign investment. And the first and the biggest recipient of foreign investment to date, as is well known, is Hungary. And it's worthwhile looking at Hungary because earlier this year, the Hungarians produced some figures which demonstrated that 41% of their exports last year came from new factories constructed with foreign investment. Now, that's an extraordinary figure, 41%. But if you look at the figure of foreign direct investment into Hungary and you see it's $14 billion for a country of only 10 million people, that is a pretty substantial inflow for a pretty small country. If you compare it with a measly $4 billion for Russia, you can see that Russia, I mean, it's, as our American friends say, it's really Mickey Mouse. And it's all to come. I mean, Russia is for the 21st century. But Russia was, of course, going to be the great economic success story of the 20th century, and probably would have been had it not been for that nice Mr. Lenin in his path. So you had the switch of trade. You had a switch of trade away from Comecon and a switch to the European Union markets, which, for all the criticism of the European Union, and nobody criticizes it more than me, countries like Germany have been crucial to the success, or the successful conversion of the Central European economies. Germany is a very big market, it's a very rich market, and above all, because they screwed up in the way they colonized Eastern Germany and imposed upon Germany a cost level and a currency and a totally irrealistic currency level, this has meant that it has been great for cheap Polish Czech glass makers, cement makers, steel manufacturers, building workers, and so on and so forth, to actually deliver into East Germany, which is right next door, precisely the kind of really basic materials. And we're not talking about rocket science, we're talking about really basic commodities, because if you look at the commodity composition of the trade of these countries from Central Europe and the former communist bloc, most of it is pretty standard stuff. And Germany, with that huge construction boom in East Germany was a magnet that poured, that helped to, that attracted a lot of low price, fairly high quality, standard products from countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Czech and Slovakia, Hungary, and as far as Ukraine as well. Ukrainian steel is also going in there. And of course, things like the shipping. The one of the great success stories in the export turnaround has been, for example, the Polish shipping industry, which was a disaster in the 1970s and 1980s. And which, particularly in the Szczecin yard, has in the space of 2 or 3 years completely turned around. It's a very, very, very efficient plant, and 90% of, well, 90, I think it's 95 or 99%, an enormous proportion. Most of its output is exported, and the vast bulk of that is, of the ships are actually exported to Germany. So that's steel, that's manpower, that's engines. And all that, of course, has a knock-on effect. And the development, the recovery of the Polish and other Central European economies has been essentially export-led, and that is very largely thanks to the European Union being prepared to accept what are still actually, in terms of this huge market of 360 million people, very small quantities. Poland was able to increase its foreign trade last year by over 40%, but even so, the total volume of two-way trade was, I think, around $60 billion. Now, that's very small. Or you look at Russia, for example. The total volume of the value of Russia's exports, mainly oil and gas, last year was $78 billion. Well, a country like Holland exports more than that, you know? So really, it's small beer, so there is plenty of room for continuing expansion, even though the trade will have to flourish in the face of all sorts of hidden barriers and so on. And the best argument to use, I think, against those who want to impose restrictions on trade, on imports and so on from Eastern Europe, is that, of course, you know, nobody exports in order to have dollar bills stuck up on the lavatory wall. You export in order to get the hard currency that you require to import. And one of the main beneficiaries of the resurgence of the economies of Central Europe, and in future the Soviet Union, well, the former Soviet Union, Ukraine, Russia, and so on, will of course be the advanced economies of Western Europe, who will be supplying, as they have been doing and are doing, increasing volumes of machine tools, of industrial equipment, of semi-manufacturers, and so on and so forth. It's not a zero-sum game. Trade, as we've seen globally, is a game where the freer it is, the better it is for everybody, and that is certainly also the case in trade between the divided halves, the formerly divided halves of Europe. And as to the potential, I think it's illustrative if one just takes one example. Again, I'm sorry if I keep coming back to Poland, but Poland is very interesting in so many ways. It's the biggest, it's 40 million people, it's between Germany and Russia, it's strategically important, it started off first. For many, many reasons, it's been very successful. In the 1950s, Spain and Poland had pretty well the same GDP. Now, don't ask me what it was, I can't remember, but it was, you know, it was low, but it was more or less the same. By 1994, the population is about the same too, nearly 40 million and so on, medium-sized country. Again, in the periphery of Europe. Spain on the western periphery, Poland on the eastern periphery. By 1994, these two countries, which were in the mid-50s, were more or less the same in terms of GDP and so on. The Spanish GDP was $545 billion,
seven times the $82 billion of Poland. And if anybody wants to compare the relative virtues of the Soviet-style economy and free markets, and don't forget, Franco did not die until 1975, I think, around there. And, Spain was still, an authoritarian country for much of this time. But the crucial element here, or one of the important elements, was the prospect of entry into the European Union. And between 1984, in the decade between 1984 and 1993, Spain attracted $160 billion of foreign investment. Now that compares with a total of $14 billion attracted into the entire former Soviet area of 460 million people last year. And as this transition report again points out, last year's total of 14 billion was double the 7 billion of the year before. So these are the sort of figures we're talking about. And here I'd like to come back to my original point that we are now, that the flywheel is now starting to pick up speed. Very slow start, the jet plane was slow in taking off, but it is now gathering momentum. Trade is increasing 15%, 20%, 30% growth a year in the Central European countries, and also further afield. You mentioned Albania. You look at the Baltic countries as well, countries like Croatia, countries like Slovenia. They are picking up. And if one, I've been asked to talk about the prospects for the future, so I think I'll stop there. There's so many things that one can say, of course, but there's too much actually to say. So I'll stop there just by saying that the flywheel in all these aspects that we've mentioned, in investment, in trade, and I can't remember what the other one was. The flywheel is definitely gathering speed, and provided people don't put artificial obstacles in the way, the 21st century ought to be a much more prosperous century for the people of Central Europe and Eastern Europe, and that is good for them and it's good for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Do we have any questions following on from that? Gentlemen in the foyer.
You're so very positively about the Russian economy, the standard of living for France, did you correctly, the standard of living for most Russian people, saying that figures like $300 around for income are really relevant, yet the standard of living is high now as before?
Hello. I was just wondering, from the money program on BBC Two, for example, the sort of images I get from there are of a complete breakdown of the financial system, that people living in Russia are no longer using money, that they're relying upon barter, that they're producing goods and trying to sell them, and that there's almost a return to a medieval sort of economy there, to the extent that crossroads between roads and rails are becoming key trading centres where people are simply bringing what goods they can and trying to trade them and to increase the standard of living in that.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the two accounts aren't quite right. I can't see the join, whether there's a join.
Thank you. Can I ask
that?
Well, firstly, I think that if you historically trade has been the quickest way of accumulating capital. And if you want to create capitalism, you've got to have capital. And I see the dynamism, if you like, or the just the crude vitality of Russia as something which fills me with optimism for the future. I lived in Russia under Brezhnev, the last years of Brezhnev, and the first few years of that nice liberal whiskey-drinking Mr. Andropov, who threw me out. And I remember by January, the onions were rotting, and all you could get in the stores were moldy potatoes, rotting cabbage, and you had to wait hours in the snow to get it. I mean, not me. I mean, I went to the hard currency store, but, you know, most Russians, life was very hard. You didn't get, you know, just a huge range of things which are now available you couldn't have. Now, of course, the doors of the Ritz are open to everybody, and then the capitalist system, one of the reasons why the shops are always full is that most people can't afford to buy everything all the time. And clearly, you know, that is part of the reason why, you know, the shops are now full in the Soviet Union, in Russia. I mean, in Soviet days, you know, bread was so cheap. Bread, even though it was made with 40 million tons of expensive imported grain, it was so cheap that you'd go around the country areas and you'd see these ladies, fat ladies on bicycles with a whole chain of it round their neck with a hole through and a piece of string, and they were going to feed it to the pigs. You know, well, you know, that doesn't make sense. And so what I think has happened in the Soviet Union, I keep saying the Soviet Union, I hope you will excuse me, but that was, you know, this is a sort of professional deformation that when I was dealing with the Soviet Union, that's what it was, and in many respects, I mean, I'm talking about this area under the Soviet Empire. It was not at all a consumer society, but there was certainly a basic level of subsistence, if you like. I mean, you could buy a whole loaf for 16 kopecks. And for 16 kopecks, that's what people did. They bought a whole loaf. I used to do it myself. I cut off a slice, and then, you know, by the next day it was green and moldy, and I threw the whole thing away. And if you went round the rubbish bins of the housing estates of Moscow, which you had to do because they were overflowing, like mine was, with moldy bread, which was full of imported grain. And that's the kind of thing that happened. You did have bread, and you did have vodka. And also you could walk down the street, more or less, with the only danger of falling into a pothole or being assaulted by a drunk. And now they tell me that it's much more dangerous. There's much more theft, there's much more to steal. I mean, there's no theft before because there was nothing to steal. I mean, I've been in so many people's apartments where there was nothing. Nothing, apart from the standard television, which, you know, was often not on because if you switched it on too often, it tended to explode. So, but the final thing I think that I would like to say is that there is now a huge dynamism about Russia. And you mentioned the Middle Ages, and in one respect, I really would agree with you. In the Middle Ages, people died early. After 75 years of Soviet rule, people are dying early. That the accumulation of war, of deprivation, of bad medical health, and one thing and another, boredom, all sorts of things, drunkenness, all those other things which were the great sort of leitmotif of life behind the Soviet Union, has had a terrible impact on people, and particularly the poor, the old, and the young. And that what is happening, if one looks at the demography, and I'm not saying that Russia is a happy country, it is not a happy country. The young are not having, those of childbearing age are not having children. They're anxious about the future, and all their energy is going into trying to build some kind of life for themselves, a career for themselves, a nest, if you like, whatever, under the most excruciatingly difficult circumstances in many cases. The old are dying in droves, often quietly up in the 13th floor, you know. And if you look at those figures, the declining life expectancy, the rising death rates and the lowering and the reduction in birth rates, you know, there are all the signs of a human society in a tremendous state of shock. So I hope I didn't put, you know, too much of a gloss on Russia. I'm not saying that this is a place where, you know, the land flowing with milk and honey. It's a country under enormous stress, but a country which, because it is concentrated, if you like, in that generation, in the 15 to 45 year olds, if you like, as in the Middle Ages, there is an enormous raw energy about the place, which I find enormously encouraging.
Thank you, Anthony, for a very full
answer. It's a very long, long meandering reply.
What's more, Russia in 2 minutes? gentleman with the pen.
You mentioned that the collapse of Comic-Con was essentially good, and I agree, Comic-Con was quite a dysfunctional organization. But the notion that a growth in Central and Eastern Europe currently is trade-led and in respect with the EU, I couldn't disagree more, really. These countries never got what they expected from European Union. Fortress Europe is still closed for steel, agriculture, textiles, really the products that Central and Eastern European countries can export. And can you comment on that, and can you comment on the idea of some kind of regional economic integration in Central and Europe as a kind of a playgroup before the full membership in European Union as well? Thank you.
Very, very briefly, I'll answer very briefly, and then perhaps if somebody else would like to say. Look, there are a lot of obstacles. Chris is going to be dealing with the European Union side of it. They could have been a lot more generous on the trade thing, that's for sure. But if you look at the figures, there has actually been quite an increase in all those categories that you mentioned, despite the fact that they put all these quota restrictions and other things on them. I think that is true. The second point, it was ungenerous, unnecessary, and it shouldn't have happened. The second thing, the fastest now, after that shift from east to west, which took place very soon after the collapse of communism, the fastest growing area of trade in all these countries now is actually trade between themselves. And you have now the Central European Free Trade Area, which is helping that. But the main thing is, you go to a place like the Patak market south of Łódź, which does a turnover of about $5 billion a year of people who come from Lithuania, from the Crimea, from Belarus, from all over, with those plastic bags and $2,000 in their pocket, and it's all cash trade, and there's thousands of them, and they come over the border, and it's that kind of trade which is taking place. And also in the Polish case, instead of shipping coal all the way up through Poland and then exporting it at a loss, increasingly volumes of coal are being sold where they always used to be, next door in the Czech Republic. And that makes sense. So there's much more rational trade now.
Okay. Thank you. I found that very stimulating. In fact, I wanted to ask a couple of questions myself. So if we don't have any at the end, I certainly would take issue a couple of times with Anthony and ask some other questions. Because that really was a super coverage. I'd now like to pass us over to Krista Bowman, who is Senior Advisor at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Prior to that, he was Planning Director at Morgan Grenfell and has significant experience in the steel industry. He's also a member of the Centre for Economic Performance at LSE. So a gentleman who has a great deal of experience, particularly in the steel. Krista, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, the previous speakers have been trying to cover about 30 countries and large parts of the Asian and European landmass. So I'm less ambitious. I think I will concentrate principally, because my title is enlargement and all that, on the four main countries I started operating in, though I know Russia and Ukraine a little bit. Now, 5 years ago this last winter was my first introduction to Poland, although I had been to Central Europe in the 60s. And I remember on a snowy day in February, wandering the streets of Warsaw, thinking, what have I done? Why am I doing this? This was a grim sort of Siberian experience. And when you got out of Warsaw, Katowice, the largest industrial town in Poland, you couldn't get a phone line back to Warsaw. The cars were either the old sort of Lada type or the sort of 50s Fiats or the Trabants, whatever. The grey streets meant, you know, there was nothing to entice you and out unless you had Polish friends or were very well informed. It was a grim, grim scene. Now, for those of you looking for this kind of excitement, I have to disappoint you. Things have changed very much. You can still find that, of course, if you want it in the Urals or Siberia or parts of the Balkans. But in these countries, the changes, as Peter and Tony have been saying, have been shocking and amazing. And this really relates to the whole issue of what does enlargement mean here? Now, enlargement at one level is, of course, a very important political event, because it is the sort of the end of the Cold War. Can we have these countries back, please, in the West? That is where they belong, particularly as far as the Visegrad countries of Central Europe are concerned. They have long-standing Western traditions, legal traditions, cultural traditions, and so on. And it's great that they are now able to interact with that, with us. And of course, it's very important to them from a security point of view, as they never hesitate to remind one. So there's a political thing which is always in danger of getting bogged down in detailed discussions of raspberries or steel quotas or harmonization of capital adequacy ratios, which take through the night in Brussels. And we mustn't lose that. And I think the British are better than average at keeping that vision in mind, a political vision. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think there's something fundamentally different from what happened when, for example, Greece and Portugal came into the then community. Because there is a sense in which transition and enlargement are kind of sort of the same thing. They're not the same thing in a number of detailed points. But what is happening here is that these countries, particularly Poland, the Czech and Slovak republics, Hungary and perhaps Slovenia, particularly those countries, are in a sense doing two things at once. They are making this transition with extraordinary rapidity, have made a lot of it already, and they are doing so based on a European Union model. What do I mean by that? I do not mean endless, enormous books of procedures which have to be gone through by lawyers and bureaucrats and accountants to match every single harmonization of the acquis communautaire in Brussels. I'm really referring to two models to which they are working. And they are, in one sense, they are trade-led. And as Tony said, their most important model is Europe. We come back to that. But perhaps more importantly, they are led by the model of Western Europe since the war. When we all got rich, we had the golden age of 50s, 60s, early 70s, some recovery after a collapse, but some recovery in the 80s. That is what they want. And they do not have the naivety of some of the East Germans who thought they could have it overnight. Most of them certainly now know that it is a process. Now we come back, I like the way Tony referred to constructive destruction. And I think this should be the center of your thoughts. And for those of you who are economists, I have to apologize for the fact that we pinched Nick Stern from you onto Conrad. He's the midwife really of this transition report. And you'll be interested when you get to transition indicators in it, which I recommend. The only two economists, two famous economists, mentioned in the footnotes. Guess who they are? Yes, Schumpeter and Hayek. This is not sort of classic economics. This is about a complete change in the economy. And of course, it's not a change being directed by some prime minister or finance minister. They couldn't do it. That was the old system. It's a change being pushed through by the essentially the entrepreneurs. Now, those are various kinds of entrepreneurs. They include people still running the same enterprises as in the old system. They include people starting small businesses. And they have to do something far, far harder than any businessman in Britain or Germany or the States. They have to kind of imagine a new economy, especially at home. All these figures about growth, I mean, I don't believe them either. I'm like Tony here. Because the old economy was crazy. I mean, one of the best accounts of the old system is a book I'm sure you know by the Croatian feminist Slavenka Draculic, which is a wonderful title of How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. And she makes very strongly the point that I think Tony referred to it not supplying anything for man or beast. Well, I don't know about man or beast, but it certainly didn't supply anything to women. It was appalling at consumer goods, that economy. And leaving aside Russia, we're talking here about Central Europe, which was much closer. So the opportunities for creating a new economy are enormous. Now, the easiest way of doing that, of course, is for the multinational. I remember one of the first meetings I went to in Poland was on the thrilling subject of detergents, not a subject I'd previously studied very deeply. But of course, it's a classic case study in transition, that the old detergents didn't work. Polish housewives were voting with their hands. And the question was, who was going to transform this before the whole market got overwhelmed by imports? And in practice, of course, it was the multinationals moving very quickly. Ditto the car industry. Multinationals have moved in. But in a lot of other sectors, the smaller sectors, obviously, the restaurants, the shops, distribution, a whole lot of components. These are being done in Poland by Poles, in Hungary by Hungarians, and so on and so on. And they have to use their imagination. There are no textbooks telling them what to do. Also, there's no information. I mean, if you want to set up a business in Britain, you call a marketing expert, and he tells you, in general, what the market for your product is. Unless it's revolutionary. Well, they didn't have that there. They have to invent it. And of course, they can make mistakes. But the opportunities are fantastic. Now, I talk about the domestic market and the changes in that domestic market, and therefore the European Union as a model. Those societies are modeling themselves on our society for better or for worse. The trade issues are very important. I agree totally with Tony that this has been a dynamic force for their economies. And perhaps just dealing with the question about steel, textiles and agriculture. No one, I think, here would defend the treatment of agriculture, except to say that conditions in West European farms aren't totally easy, but they're certainly harder on Polish and Hungarian farms. Textiles and clothing is complicated. There is outward processing. It's not all bad. Steel, a subject I know something about, is not an ideal story. It is important, particularly for the Czech Republic. But the exports have been growing. And the important thing to bear in mind is that nobody wants to export steel if they can export a much higher value product made from steel. And what is good is that all these countries, the Central European ones, are doing that. There is a very substantial amount of manufactured exports going into Western Europe. And that is part of the drive here. So this is the level of analysis, the enterprise and what they're doing. Now the related issue, which is extremely important, is that of banks. I think most people have been taught that banks are important, but they probably didn't really understand how important, especially in these economies. And the banks at the time of the change were in a pretty bad state, and they went on lending fairly stupidly for a long time because they were lending to enterprises which existed regardless of whether they were making anything anyone bought. So absolutely central to the process has been the transformation of the banks, often regionalization of banks, sometimes twinning with an international bank, but not always, so that they become important actors, that they are able to make decisions. And that, of course, brings one back to European Union harmonization. They have to harmonize, just like British banks do or Greek banks do. But the reason they have to harmonize is not really to fill in some bureaucratic form to send to Brussels or Frankfurt. The reason they have to harmonize is so that they are as effective as a German or a British bank. Otherwise, they'll be out of business. And they are harmonizing pretty quickly with that in mind. I've emphasized the enterprise. A lot has to go on, of course, administratively. One of the very dangerous things in all these economies, even the best, has been the difficulty of government to be effective. Because there was, of course, a loss of confidence in government. There were people who said governments are irrelevant, the market rules. But of course, if you look at Western Europe, governments are terribly important for setting the framework in all sorts of detailed ways. And really everything to do with harmonization assumes you have a very sophisticated, competent government to hold the ring, to draw up the regulations, to harmonize the regulations, to enforce, hopefully, some compliance here and there and so on. They didn't have that kind of government, and they have to create them. They have to get coordination between ministries who have often not talked to each other. And a major problem in the privatization process has, of course, been that when we set up restructuring funds, we've always found that ones that involve government go much, much more slowly than ones that don't involve government. I could talk about a lot of case studies here. We have an immense number of case studies, both the ones that have succeeded and the ones that have failed. The ones that have failed, I don't mean so much that have lost money. There aren't all that many of those, but that have just been shown they did not have the management and leadership to make this very, very difficult transition, and can you blame them? Now, I'm billed at referring to the consequences here for the European Union, which is a vast and difficult topic. And I'll just focus on one or two issues. Again, I think as Tony said, this whole area is rather small. I'm delighted to see so many people here. But would you have all come here to have a discussion about the economic prospects of the Netherlands? Well, all the East European countries, I think excluding the Soviet Union, but have a domestic product less than that of the Netherlands. So this is not, and Russia and Ukraine is a whole different scene, as I would emphasize. So am I saying Central Europe is sort of small and not very interesting? On the contrary, it has been one of the most dynamic areas in terms of the growth of trade, but from a low base. And if you look at what its significance is for the rest of us, the first is, as Tony mentioned, it is a fantastic market. We, Western Europe, that is, has a positive trade balance with those countries, I emphasize. And of course, you can criticize that. You say that shows our markets are closed. There's an element of truth in that. But it's very desirable we have a positive trade balance, because what that means, of course, in economic terms, is that they are getting the finance to make that possible. So they're getting the money, and we are getting the jobs. That is actually happening, that virtuous circle. And so we are exporting sophisticated things to them. But actually, I think on a larger scale, all this is probably less important to Europe generally, than what it means to Germany. Germany is at the center of the European economy. If you look at the proportion, Germany has, for example, 75% more exports than France to the rest of the existing European Union. It has 6.5 times as much more exports to the countries of Central and Southeastern Europe. So this is really Germany's playground. And the advantages to them are great. Again, you can say, well, on the figures, it isn't that important, is it? But of course, in terms of the effect on their structure, the effect on the threat to their cost base, it's very, very significant how they develop interdependencies. Do they develop it through investment, which has been less than you might expect in a country like Poland, but it's still there? Do they do it through trade? Do they do it through joint ventures of one kind or another? But I think they're going to do it, and they are doing it. And if you look, again, if you're narrowly concerned with the significance for Britain here, I guess that the economic significance of Central Europe for Britain is principally its effect on Germany. Because Germany is so important to British exports that if it makes a 2% difference to German exports, to German imports from Britain, that's probably more important. Certainly the growth of imports in Germany from Britain in the last 4 or 5 years is much greater than that from Central and Eastern Europe. So I think we have to be realistic from our smaller economy in Britain. A lot of this is about Germany, what happens in Germany, their benefit to these countries as a market, whether in supermarkets or in components in factories, or the other way around, the sales from Germany. So I think, finally, I assume that many of you are here not just out of academic interest, but because you're thinking, should you spend the next 5 or 10 years of your lives concerned with these economies, or alternatively, Asia or Latin America or California, or even Britain. I have found it very, very exciting the last 5 years. The changes have been very, very rapid. I think there is an enormous difference now between the really rough, tough economies of Russia and Ukraine, with all their glamour and sometimes excitement. You have to kind of wear your armor-plated waistcoat there. I don't mean literally, but you have to be more careful there, and the conditions of spending a weekend in the Urals are tougher and grimmer. In Central Europe, it isn't like that. I mean, it's getting to be like Madrid or Helsinki or whatever. Is that so exciting? Well, it is exciting commercially and economically and financially. The opportunities are very, very great. And I suspect a lot of you will be taking advantage of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. Do we have any questions relating to the EU issue?
Yes, we do have upstairs.
Sir, I see you.
I have more of a comment than a question, and it's mainly about the difference between Central Europe and the former Soviet Union, which we've danced around but hasn't been articulated so much. And I don't know much about the social history of the region extending back, but as far as what my intuition tells me is that the former Soviet Union does not have the political institutional memory that the Central European countries do, in terms of understanding the political give and take of checks and balances and how that affects economic reform, economic decisions. It seems to me that in Central Europe they're going back to where they were 50 years ago in terms of development, in terms of innovation, and closing the technology gap, which is easier, and regarding the EU and proximity and trade, that argument falls very well. But in terms of Russia and Ukraine, they don't have that institutional memory. They're starting from scratch, And they are going to have such a much more difficult time creating those checks and balances, which has resulted in a slower reform, has resulted in many different things. It also seems that that affects in Russia the structure of the grasping of the natural resources, as was discussed earlier, and that even though privatization has occurred, it's still in the hands of those old communists, that even though ownership may be more private than it was several years ago, what does that really mean in terms of the political dynamics and future reform? I'm not sure that it's as clear as everyone is saying.
Well, Stephanie will deal with some of that for Russia, but I don't think anyone is saying it's clear. I have emphasized very strongly the difference in my view. I'm therefore agreeing, I think, with your premise. I think they are entirely different. I think the first discipline you need to operate successfully in Central Europe is history. And at lunchtime, I was listening to Norman Davis, and anyone who goes to Poland not having read his book of 2,000 years of Polish history is mad. You have to understand the history. And that is the basic, before you can get to the business or the economics and whatever. And yes, I can entirely agree, it is the historical and social infrastructure which is making particularly those Central European countries move so fast to a Western European model. And the changes in Russia particularly, which I have some optimism, I don't think they're going to end up in the same model. The economy, the society, the history is very, very different.
Could you just shortly comment on the prospects of Slovakia and whether you think that they are going to proceed in a Western world or whether they might rather turn east, and whether democratic reforms are a necessary precondition for transactions with the European community?
Well, yes, the question was about the prospects for Slovakia connected with democratic reforms and accession to the European Union. Well, I think I would simply comment on Slovakia, that it's no secret that they have a long way to go in democratic reforms. And that has been, I think, put to them by not the European Union and the United States and everyone pretty strongly. It is, however, interesting that their economy is growing great guns and is one of the most successful in Central Europe. That is something to do with the fact that they have a very good steel company in Eastern Slovakia, which is selling a lot of steel. They've got chemicals, they've got other things that were put there for political reasons. And so you cannot make any simple statement about Slovakia. Some good things are happening in Slovakia. But until the democratic reforms go a bit further, I think politically they will be treated at arm's length.
Could you possibly just briefly outline which countries would be most attractive for European Union membership within the region?
Well,
and at what time?
Yes. I mean, everyone will have their own views, and what I express here is a personal view. But I think that the business view would clearly be that Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, and possibly Slovenia, are in the lead. And Slovakia could be there if they could get there, if they wanted, if the political leadership was interested in democracy. By a whole range of indicators, are way ahead of other countries, and I must be careful who I offend here. But none of the Southeast European countries have got the same progress in privatization, in banking reform, in entrepreneurial activity as the ones in Central Europe. And the Baltic states, some of them have made very good progress, notably Estonia, but there are a number of political problems, and there are still some industrial problems to be solved before you can really regard them as European economies in the way I have no hesitation about Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary.
Can I just say a word about Slovakia?
Okay. I'd just like to say a word about Slovakia. It does seem to me that a certain tolerance is required. All countries have got their own problems, and certainly in this part of the world. And Slovakia is a country which never really existed before, or when it did exist very briefly in the 1940s, it was as a Nazi puppet state. And that was not the fault of the Slovaks. I mean, that was how the cards fell in Europe at that time. And I'm no great fan of Mr. Mečar, but he has been elected, admittedly, by only 35% of the electorate. But then, you know, we in this country are also ruled by governments, minority governments, if you like, as a permanent state, as it were. And I think it is important to remember that the division between the Czechs and the Slovaks, which I was, must say, very dubious about at the time, I now think was probably a good idea, because there quite clearly are a lot of resentments, and the Slovaks do have a lot of chips on their shoulder. And I think it probably is very good that they are now responsible for their own fate, and also for their successes and for their failures. And I think that, you know, Slovakia really, it's not the conventional democracy and so on and so forth. And I think that we perhaps should be a little bit patient and just see how things develop there without rushing in, and certainly not make things particularly hard for them.
Thank you. Poignant stuff. Our lives are going to change a great deal, I fear, in the next 3-4 decades, and certainly those of our children will see a very different Europe, a very different economic construct. I'd now like to pass us on to our final speaker. I hope she won't feel embarrassed, but I would like to mention that as of last Friday, which I think is a superb accolade, she was voted Young Financial Journalist of the Year. It's Stephanie Flanders, and I think even that deserves a round of applause. Stephanie is going to talk to us about the economic perspectives, and particularly the events which are going to take place in June in Russia, of which there is a great deal of debate already. More opinions than I think there are political parties.
Well, I'm very honoured to be here, but it is a sort of cruel and unusual punishment to get a journalist to actually answer her own questions. I was looking at the programme earlier today, these questions that I'd rather ambitiously rattled off to the organiser, and I thought it struck me that I didn't really know the answer to any of them. But my consolation is that we're talking about Russia and Russian economic policy, and that means I'm pretty sure that no one knows what Russian economic policy is going to be next week, let alone in 7 weeks' time after the presidential elections. We had the Russian ambassador for lunch at the Financial Times last week, and actually our foreign editor asked him, he said, "It must be terrible, how you can possibly represent the ambassador for a government when no one ever seems to know what it thinks on any issue." He said, "No, it's fantastic. I can say whatever I want. And I know that there's one person in the government who probably thinks the same thing." So in that spirit, and I'll try to keep it slightly briefer because we're getting on to the 9 o'clock watershed, I guess I'll talk very briefly about where we are now, where we have been the last year on the sort of economic front, what the biggest risks are for the next 7 weeks or so as we all wait to see what happens in the presidential election, and then the really easy answers, which is what's going to happen in 7 weeks' time. Where we are now is really well symbolised by something that happened today, actually, in Paris, which is the final agreement of the rescheduling of the Russian sovereign debt to official creditors, the so-called Paris Club deal. Now, this has been said to be the sort of final piece in the macro jigsaw for Russia, the turnaround that's happened in the last year. The other pieces are rescheduling of the commercial debt, which is also inherited from the Soviet Union. That happens sort of in principle in December with the London Club creditors. But actually, the Russian officials who were in Paris this morning are now in London sorting out the final final sort of P's and Q's of that rescheduling deal. So we have that in place. And of course, all of this is premised on Russia sticking to the third piece of the jigsaw, which is the three-year extended fund facility, $10.2 billion loan, which it received from the IMF. There was final agreement on that last month at the IMF board. Now, that deal, which was quite controversial, obviously, in this context of the election, was a reward for good behaviour. Now, everyone, you know, the last year, we've had this turnaround with very tight monetary and fiscal policies. The budget deficit, which was over 10% in all the years up to that, was 4.8% in 95. The inflation, monthly inflation last month was 2.8% compared to nearly 20% at the beginning of last year. So you have all these sort of macro achievements, but obviously there's this huge worry hanging over everyone that it's all going to come crashing down on their heads, partly with an election result which actually lives out some of the microeconomic and political failures which have taken place over the same time as this macro success. In my mind, when I think of the microeconomic failures, I'm thinking about the failure to really increase tax revenues the way they needed to last year, which actually meant that spending had to be cut much more tightly than they thought. Now, that has been combined with another political failure, which is a failure to prevent some of this rent-seeking, which Peter Boom was talking about earlier in the privatisation deals, these very, well, the word opaque is always attached to them in FT deal, in FT articles, but the opaque privatisation shares for loan schemes with the banks. Those two things, I think, are sort of some of the most important things, but there's also been a bigger political failure, which I think relates to the point that you were making earlier, which is really a failure to sort of make the case for economic reform. I mean, you've actually had the reforms going through by hook or by crook, at least parts of them, and that certainly the macro stability is there. But you still haven't got the credibility of reform the way that you had and the way you needed to have with the sort of shock therapy of the Central and East European countries. And I think you're right that there's a sort of institutional memory thing which helps that. But there's just we talk about the credibility of reforms, and we often mean sort of market credibility. But I think there's a credibility that Klaus and others had, which came from a sort of general political consensus, you know, not about exactly where we were going, but basically where the, you know, agreement on reform, agreement on wanting to do and become more like Western Europe and join the EU. And that gave credibility to the government's efforts to move fast and to do these shock reforms. Whereas in Russia, you've had a sort of strange combination of sort of non-credible gradualism, that they've just about done these things, but no one's ever quite sure whether they're going to continue, and that political consensus just doesn't seem to be there. And the real, I think, one of the political failure of last year was that we didn't get that in combination with the macroeconomic strategy. What you had, in fact, was Yeltsin responding to his declining popularity with a sort of this lurch in the nationalist direction and preying on people's feelings that they'd lost an empire and that, you know, everyone else got their nationhood debate. Ukraine got to talk about being a new country. All these places got, and all that Russia happened to Russia was it lost an empire, you know. So they suddenly had this debate about nationhood that other countries had had previously during the reforms. Now that's actually had, that's got economic costs actually. I mean, you have Chechnya. I say that's probably the worst question on that list was the cost of Chechnya, because no one knows. No one has any idea how much Chechnya cost. The person actually in charge of the Budget Appropriations Committee was interviewed in Izvestia a couple of weeks ago and said, well, I can't hazard a figure. I mean, some people mentioned $2 billion, some people mentioned $5 billion. Because the truth is, I just give a certain amount of money to the military, and I have absolutely no idea how they spend it. And that's been true for, you know, for the last 2 years. You still have these sort of black boxes in the budget that no one quite dares enter and knows what goes on inside them. So you have these kind of economic costs weighing down on the program. Some of these have actually got worse in the first few months. Now, as Peter said, I mean, this democratic impetus has actually meant that they're getting their act together on all the wages that they didn't pay last year and increasing, Yeltsin announcing increases in pensions. But because they're not improving the tax system and the loopholes aren't getting any smaller and people are actually just not paying taxes because there's so much political uncertainty. Tax revenues have come in way, way below. I think it's 68% of what they needed in the first quarter of this year. So this is actually putting big pressure on the IMF to withdraw from its program, because it just looks as though they're not going to meet many of these targets that were set. I mean, the other things that have been happening is the trade liberalization, which Russia has repeatedly promised the IMF, and there was again a promise that these quantitative restrictions, again, the things that support the rent-seeking that Peter was talking about, would be finally lifted. And there's been a lot of foot-dragging, and a lot of the decrees that you need to actually comply with it aren't being promulgated, or if they, you know, they may be announced, but they don't actually get implemented. For example, you know, Gazprom, one of the biggest things last year was that everyone felt, hey, my wages aren't being paid, my pension's declining in value, but Gazprom is just making more and more money. All of these rich fat cats, you know, it's like it's sort of a writ enormous, the fat cat debate that we have in Britain. And there was one of the reasons why Gazprom wasn't paying any taxes was that there was a stabilization fund that they had for all their investments, where they basically hid all their profits. And they said it was an investment, but actually it was just where all the profits were. And the IMF finally came in and said, look, we know your game. If you don't get rid of this, this is one of the things that's part of our conditions for the loans. And sure enough, Yeltsin announced in a decree that this stabilization fund had been abolished. Unfortunately, no one's actually seen this decree. It's not actually been promulgated. No one's quite sure what's happened to it. And actually, most people, I can't say this, and I probably wouldn't say this in the paper, there's a strong suspicion that Gazprom has actually, all those profits have actually disappeared and been put into subsidiaries. And there were other decrees that were passed on the same day that have actually made all those subsidiaries tax exempt. So somehow, it's sort of, they say the right things to the IMF, but it doesn't quite happen. Now, if you look at the risks over the next 7 weeks or so, if it was a normal country, if it wasn't Russia, we'd say, looking at it as an investor, well, the biggest risk is that the IMF's going to pull out. But I think actually most people think that's the smallest risk in the next 7 weeks, because the IMF is a hugely political decision. The IMF does not want to be thought to be losing Russia, in that great phrase. And the political consequences for them of pulling out and seeming to withdraw support from Yeltsin at this crucial time are too horrendous for them to contemplate. And I put on that thing, you know, would they be right to do this? I think you can get very prissy, and I've probably written this in a couple of my leaders for the FT about supporting policies and not personalities, and that's the important thing, and that the IMF should keep to its principles. But it certainly wouldn't be the first time that the IMF or any other organisation had given a political leader associated with doing the right things some degree of room for manoeuvre in the lead-up to an election of this kind. And I think it's really important to look at the alternative when you talk about these debates. I mean, Zhuganov, I don't quite share some of the optimism of Pete Boone on this, but Zhuganov, a lot of people in Moscow like to say, and even outside, look, we know that he just wants a piece of the action, but everyone now has an interest in macroeconomic stability. Yes, we'll have a bit of chaos in the first few months, but actually, ultimately, you know, he too will want low inflation. He too has every interest. You know, once they've stolen their bit of the money, you know, they will want to keep the value of those goods, and everything will eventually be right, and you have to follow market principles in the end, because this is the 90s, etc. Well, I think that might be true, but it sort of forgets how completely dire things are going to be for the first couple of months if Zhuganov gets in. You've got probably a massive run on the ruble. You've got probably the stock market just completely freezing, I mean collapsing, but also, since it's only about 50 people talking on the phone, they'll just stop talking to each other because they don't know what's going on. Government bond market will also just collapse, because all of that's premised on the ruble maintaining its value and keeping within this corridor. So probably the instinct most people think for Zhuganov, I mean, his main economic advisor is actually a guy called Shatalin, who used to run Gosplan, the old planned economy system. And he's often talked, and actually Zhuganov has talked about going back to a new kind of Gosplan. Now, as Pete says, he has actually been backing down on some of these things, and he will say very moderate things. You know, I don't want to privatise everything because that would cost too much blood. I think that's probably, he's probably telling the truth when he says that. But there's absolutely no, what's frightening looking on the outside is that he has nobody who's remotely economically literate in a sort of Western sense advising him. I mean, it's just impossible to find those people. When you ask him how he'll actually pay for the things that he says he wants to pay for, you know, just after he said, oh, I want to keep moderate and I want to keep good macroeconomic stability, he has no idea. I mean, he talks a lot about protectionism, he talks a lot about all these things. So I think even if he did get to this point sometime down the road or even quite soon of saying we want to get control of the economy back, it's just very unclear that he's got any of the tools with him to do it. I mean, if he suddenly does price controls, the IMF would have got out, there would have been this huge loss of credibility from the last year's efforts, and just the thought of Zhuganov, without any backup, standing up and trying to do a fourth, or depending on how you count them, fifth Russian stabilization effort, just as it seems implausible that he would really be able to get things on track enough for us to say, you know, this is just a momentary thing. So, in that sense, I think it's defensible that the IMF is tacitly or even blatantly supporting Yeltsin. But we do have to be prissy about the outcome being democratic and being observed. I don't think any of the things I've said are an argument for us turning a blind eye if there's huge corruption in the elections, which seems perfectly possible, or worse, if Yeltsin just prevents some kind of transfer of power to Zhuganov. So having said all that, it's absolutely crucial and probably the biggest, as Pete said again, the biggest success in Russia, arguably, of the last 5 years has been that we do have these democratic checks and balances. And for that to be lost, you know, for all the short-term consequences and even medium-term consequences of Zhuganov getting in, I think would be horrendous to contemplate. So I guess, I mean, the third and final thing is, if we think that Russians should be allowed to make their own mistakes, are they actually going to do that, you know, in our sense, vote for Zhuganov? You'll be glad to know that everyone in Moscow now seems to think that Yeltsin will get in, mainly because it now seems clear he's gaining on Zhuganov. But even if he loses the first round, he's now high enough that he would definitely, most people think he'll get into the second round. And because Zhuganov has, I mean, it's again a similar situation Pete was saying about communists getting in where they can get a certain chunk of the vote because they can get the vote out and they have the old party machinery. Now, in Russia, they have still a very powerful party machinery, the Communist Party. Zhuganov has a strong support among the old and the seriously disenfranchised. But most people doubt that he would have a lot of crossover votes in the second round, i.e. people who didn't vote for him in the first round voting for him in the second round. Now, actually a poll that came out today by one of the more reputable pollsters, although it has to be said they're all pretty awful, thinks that Yeltsin would win a second round against Zhuganov, 31-29. You know, the wild card in all this, which I think is just sort of scaremongering, is that there will be a deal done between Yeltsin and Zhuganov between the first and second rounds. And in fact, there was an open letter to both of them by a large number of quite important bankers last week saying precisely this. That's the sort of scenario where Yeltsin does a deal with Zhuganov, makes Zhuganov prime minister, and says, you will be my anointed successor after I complete my term, and I might leave early. You know, I mean, looking at the health of him, he may well leave early. This is the trickiest outcome for the IMF, for anyone else, when they're thinking about the situation, because in many ways it would sort of entrench much of the sort of concentration of power, that economic and political power, which has taken place in the last few years, thanks partly to this sort of grab for assets and grab for oil revenues and all of that. And it would also cost a sort of doubt on there being those political checks and balances there. So I think we'd have to take that very seriously. My only answer is that it looks quite unlikely to happen, so I'm not going to... I don't think I can even hazard what we really ought to do if that happened. But whatever happens, and if we do think it's more likely now that Yeltsin will come through this, the key to what happens to the Russian economy in the next few years is going to be melding all of those microeconomic issues and the political failures of last, reversing those political failures onto continued macro stability. You know, we have that. I think we probably would still have that, you know, in a year's time if Yeltsin came in. What we might not have is the tax reforms that you need to make them fair, to make them unpunitive on business, to help them to help this entrepreneurial spirit to thrive, encourage companies to actually be formal and official. You know, you have this huge unofficial economy, which is partly, you know, businessmen who are scared of, you know, they're scared of the mafia, but they're also scared of having to deal to bribe petty officials to lift all these little restrictions, and they're scared of the taxes, which are incredibly high for some companies. You know, for the few companies that pay them, there is a lot. There are a lot of taxes to pay. So, tax reform, making sure that the trade really does get opened. You know, there's probably every deal with the IMF in the last 3 years has promised to lift the same export tariffs, and that each time the IMF announces we've got them to do this, and then 6 months later they say, and the most triumphant thing of all, we've got them to do this. And you say, well, hang on, didn't that happen 6 months ago? So, you need to have the open trade. And I think the most important thing, which is why we need to accept whatever comes out, or we need the people to be able to express their political views, is to have political and economic competition. As Pete said, there's been this really quite sort of unpleasant way that the assets have got distributed. You've got incredibly unequally distributed power, and economic power and political power and wealth, and that's what you're talking about when you see people feeling that they're an awful lot worse off, because they can see so many, you know, they can see these handfuls of extremely rich people, many of them around Yeltsin, and there's a worry that those people will just carry on with cemented power in the next few years, and that some of this, you know, the competitive forces that come through from opening your economy to trade and making sure that everyone, you know, maintaining property rights and having competitive industry, having competition in industry, all of those things need to be acting on that central power to make sure that you end up having an efficient economy that is economically efficient and sort of democratically up for grabs. I mean, when I said the final question sort of says a Russian Germany or a Russian Brazil, thinking about this, I think it's more a Russian United States and a Russian Brazil. I mean, you had in the 19th century a very similar thing going on in America. You had, you know, the Rockefellers, the Fords. That, you know, these were not pure, pristine capitalists. You know, they were also in cahoots with the banks. You know, Rockefeller was a banker. He owned vast chunks of industry. But there was a political, there was a democratic control on that process. And in fact, you know, in the end, there was a backlash against concentrated power, partly because of Rockefeller, and you had probably the most, toughest competition rules passed there that have ever been passed in any country. And so you had a country with vast inequalities that was actually dynamic and contestable enough. You know, power, economic and political power was contestable enough for it to be an efficient country and actually a decent place to live. It was actually a market economy and a democracy. Now, the hope is that that can happen. That can happen in Russia. You know, the fear is that you won't have that. You'll have, as in Brazil, very concentrated power and wealth, but that power and wealth just congealing into a sort of one cronied sort of authoritarian regimes who actually thwart democracy because they're trying to hold on to their money. Now, if you know whoever wins in the election in 7 weeks' time, that's not going to be decided. But I think, you know, someone has to win, and someone has to win reasonably fairly for them to even begin to go on the better path to the United States. So just to bear that in mind, there's a lot of there's one thing that will be decided in the election, but it's not really the whole future of Russia.
I now find myself in that dilemma because we started late and we've overrun by about the same time frame of lateness, and we have the lure of food, but I think there will be also old drinks at least. But I think there's some questions, and we've had a superb expose of that country which we always think was called Eastern Europe. I think we now know, in fact, that country called Eastern Europe that doesn't exist on the map is a whole multitude of different issues, none of which are necessarily going to come together. So I'm sure we're going to have some stimulating questions. Gentleman at the back. Deepak, when are we going to be thrown out? Forcibly or otherwise? When will we be thrown out?
No, we can stay there as long
as well. Not too long. Please.
Yeah, my question relates more to Central Europe, but could equally apply to Russia. The current growth and strong expansion in the Visegrad countries mostly, but in other East European countries as well, is largely attributable to catch up. At least I hope the panel would agree with me. But eventually, possibly, at least that's my view, growth will slow down and come to a steady state. If growth and prospects and living standards do come to a steady state in the sort of near future, is there not a risk that people's expectations in Central and Eastern Europe would be disappointed? And would that not be a risk in political terms and could generate instability in the coming 10 or 15 years?
Okay, thank you. So the question is one of, when the growth stops, are people going to become disillusioned and therefore will there be perhaps social consequences, and what might those be? Peter, that might be a question for you.
Sure.
Does this one work?
Yeah. I would say, obviously, what we care about is trying to see what are the causes of growth. And in all countries, you observe that when you can imagine that this is the first stage of what was aptly described as creative destruction, and we're on the creative side. But the problem is, in order to grow, you also need capital in the future and more investment over time. At the moment, there's a capital stock which is just being turned around and made more efficient. But the issue here is whether savings will rise, and the one difference between Asia, for example, East Asia and Eastern Europe, is the age of the population. The demographics are such that there's a very large group of people who are very old, and those people everywhere around the world have very low savings rates. And so it's hard to imagine that savings rates in Eastern Europe are going to be high enough to generate really rapid growth in the future. So you might expect, if savings rates rise a bit and if there's foreign investment, sort of modest levels of growth, and I don't see any reason why in particular it would slow down or stop as long as they're open to trade and are able to trade with the rest of Europe.
Could I just say one quick thing about that? I think that's a very valid point about the demographic composition, which is certainly not favorable to high savings and high investment. On the other hand, I sound like an economist now. There is, again, it's a point which is made here in this report, there is the combination of a low wage, reasonably well-educated, and particularly well-educated technically, population, the combination of that and state-of-the-art technology. Because the investment which is going into these places is not an old technology, it's state-of-the-art technology. And the combination of the two is a really quite phenomenal productivity growth. I mean, I think in Poland it was around about 17% last year. I mean, that's really dramatic. And those sort of productivity gains, I think, is where the savings and the capital accumulation is going to come from. And also, of course, that's what the higher standard of living is going to come from.
Gentleman with Mike.
My question follows on from something which was said last but one. I'm always worried about Germany, and one of the things that worries me is the fact that Germany has the highest unit wage costs in the world. And I ask myself how the East Central countries can afford to buy German goods. And as it seems to me, I mean, I may be wrong in this, but I put this forward as a hypothesis, the Germans have a high savings ratio, and they lend the money on to Eastern Europe, and they buy the goods. And this provides perhaps economies of scale in Germany and certainly enables them to keep their labour force up. Although we know that the employment in Germany is under tremendous strain. And I wonder, as the Eastern countries continue to accumulate debt, German debt, whether you don't reach a point where the flywheel stops. I mean, this seems to me to be a problem. Actually, I saw some figures the other day which showed that using France as an index of 100 for wage costs, Germany was 122, and Italy was 67. And I really wonder whether Germany can proceed on this basis.
Well, yes, I mean, that goes to the heart of what I was saying, and I think it is a bigger problem for Germany than for Central Europe there. The Central Europeans are getting some of the best machinery in the world, as Tony was saying, and that therefore is helping them to increase their productivity enormously. They've also got an access to the German market, so it's a wonderful combination for them and one that should stimulate a lot of growth. What does this mean for Germany? Well, Germany has of course prospered in the post-war era by making very high quality goods which were not so cost sensitive as ones made in Britain or many other countries. The issue obviously is that margin now so great that that large parts of their industry cannot continue to be undertaken in Germany? And those are exactly the questions that the Germans are answering. But I think it's wrong to put it, obviously, just in cost terms. It's always the question of, are their goods so valuable, so essential? I mean, the British have been importing, as you know, more and more German goods. 5 years, far more than they've been importing from us. So the Germans have shown they can keep up with the value-added good race, sort of almost. So that's the question for them.
Yes. The Germans certainly do have high wage costs, but they also have high productivity and they produce high quality goods, and that really is the secret of their success. But what is happening now is increasingly, we saw before that the initial investment into this region was the multinationals, the big multinational corporations. Increasingly, what we are seeing is an influx of German Mittelstand companies, these are small privately owned companies, and the German banks to finance them. And what they are doing in order to retain their competitivity on world markets, not just in the East European markets, they are increasingly sourcing their products and certainly components and so on inside in factories in the Czech Republic, in Poland and so on, which are just across the border, and then shipping them back and integrating them into their products, which have got made in Germany, stamped on them and sold at German price. So they've got lower costs, they've got a new market, but it's good for Germany, but I think it is mutually beneficial. I don't think it's something to be to be seen as dangerous or...
Thank you.
Do we have any?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment and then a question. Just some anecdotal evidence on what Tony Robinson and Christopher Bowman were speaking about. It was on the. It was an earlier questioner on the apparent paradox between the program that the chap saw and the. Standard of living in these emerging nations. Having just visited them, I would be in total agreement with Tony Robinson about they do certainly live better than what the figures do suggest. The $200 a month annual average wage per month, for example, if we take the Baltic nations, if you're going to be paying $100 for rental costs, a Big Mac with fries is about $2 to $3 for that kind of one meal. And you're looking at utilities and clothing and other food for a whole month to be paid out of, what, $100. It's just not possible. Furthermore, people tend to drive Japanese and second-hand Mercedes from the German market. Again, these types of... living standards aren't possible on the figures that are being presented to us. So I take the figures somewhat with caution. However, I would put a caveat on that, in that people are still living, perhaps three people to a room, or a family, or two families to a room. So there's quite a big discrepancy here, one that I haven't certainly understood completely, but would be in agreement with the speakers on that. My question, though, would be on foreign direct investment and how to generate particularly UK companies' interests in this region. I'm not terribly enthralled by the strategy for representing a multinational company myself, a British multinational, of following the coattails of German investment in the region. I can certainly understand German investment in its neighbouring countries, a type of sphere of influence. Certainly the Scandinavians, particularly Finland and Sweden, have that feeling towards Estonia, and Estonians feel more Nordic than they certainly feel as neighbours to Latvia or Lithuania. I would like to raise a question to the panel in that, how do you generate greater foreign investment, certainly from British companies in the region, which we don't have a tremendous historical tie. Certainly there hasn't been a tremendous trade link in the past, historically. And I would ask, what is it about some of these nations that would be attractive to us?
Can I just make a point? You talked about not historical. We actually reopened our office. We had a slight gap in St. Petersburg of about 80 years, for certain events in 1914 caused us to withdraw. And we did the same in Sofia. There the gap was slightly less, 1923. So I think one has to be very careful with broad generalizations. But in fact, there has been quite a lot of British investment in these areas, and therefore you don't necessarily say that we're not very good. We are actually quite good in some areas. But
I agree with your point. I think British investment is relatively disappointing, and I think that does not match the prospects of the region. I would simply make two points. You get little enclaves of British investment. I mean, apart from the big Pilkington investment in Poland, there's a little enclave in Wroclaw of Cadbury Schweppes, of Cousins Soap, I think it is, British Vita, and so on. And I'm told in the bars in Wroclaw now, you know, they can exchange experience. So you have that. Second, the point to the British company who is considering, and some of them are, should they invest in Central Europe or into Southeast Asia? It's hard to make that either or, but you can make the basic point that you can get in and out of Central Europe in the day in the Czech Republic, or certainly staying there one night. And therefore, the intimacy, the ability to deal there is much more like investing in Germany or Spain or whatever. And it's that kind of psychology you should have in a European context, rather than the week or fortnight you need to pursue a Southeast Asian strategy. So you can do both with different kinds of people.
I have two comments. The first is to add Saatchi and Saatchi to the list in St. Petersburg.
Thank you.
The second is also in regards to the last question, and that is the growth figure, or the income figures, aren't, well, they're misleading when you see how people live in the cities. But I would also add that that is the visible concentration of the population that people see in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And I would say that if you look at the way a pensioner lives in those cities, it's vastly different, and they certainly don't consume McDonald's. And I would also say that people that don't live in those cities don't have access to those goods and don't have the income to buy them if they did. And cities that are quite large, but not Petersburg or Moscow.
That's based on personal experience, I think.
It is true. I mean, one of the developments over the last 6 years is there has been an enormous increase in the diversity of income and the disparities of income. And you know, Russia, before the revolution, you had a small number of extremely rich people and a very large majority of peasants. Well, in economic terms, I'm afraid that's probably pretty well the pattern now, except that they're no longer peasants. They live in high-rise flats and they're unemployed and living in towns. And certainly, you know, they would not recognize my description of, you know, of a land where, you know, there are far more things. There are certainly far more things in the shops, but they remain as out of reach as ever, tantalizingly so, for millions of people.
One of the questions we've had about is, and the gentleman who asked the last question, sorry, question before that, was about how do these people survive. I mean, I've been wandering around the region for about the last 6 years and have met a vast number of this creature called an East European. And one thing that struck me a lot of the time, I'm sure you've all had experience, is, of course, we all make the assumption, and we did when we first went there, that these people all have one job. But in fact, quite often, the people have two and three jobs. And your point about the family unit, yes, there are still places in Russia, in Moscow, where you have three families living in one room. But that creates a mutual support mechanism. So they do actually have a greater economic capacity, although we may look at it as Westerners and say, gosh, those are pretty horrible living conditions, which they are, having seen them on the inside. Do we have any further questions?
Yeah, I have a question for Peter Boone. A bit going back a few hours now, someone made this allusion that if you pull a rubber band too quickly off, it doesn't hurt as much. It's possible that if you pull it off without any skill, it also leaves a scar, right? And this is specifically trying to get to the privatization matter in Russia, that it seems that this is one matter that was rushed through a little too quickly. Probably before financial restructuring should have come before this. A lot of other regulatory issues should have come before this. And it seems that that's going to leave a huge scar later on in terms of equity and possibly political instability into the long run. If you can just comment about that.
Well, yeah, you can't leap a chasm in two steps. And the cat's tail can't be cut off more than one at once. You know, you don't want to cut it off piece by piece. There are all those analogies, but in terms of and people try to use them, you know, but in terms of the what you were saying about the privatization, I think you're right, but the problem is any country you go to, they will say, our privatization was horrible. It was a disaster. We shouldn't have done it this way. We should have done it another way. Mongolia was the first country to privatize everything, and the people there today all say it was a terrible mistake, country by country. In Russia, you can look at it now and say there were mistakes, and I think there would have been ways to design it so that you didn't have enterprise directors fighting so hard to get control of the enterprise, because that, for society, is a waste. It's just dividing a pie that's a constant diameter, or making it shrink even as they fight for it. And you rather have them not fight. And in Czech, you see via these funds set up, there's less of that infighting, and it seems like the funds really have taken over control. So I think there were ways of mechanically designing it different that would have worked better at the time. But I also wonder myself, suppose they hadn't privatized, then today we'd be looking at an election where Zhuganov would be coming to power, there would be a national industry that existed. I don't know how it would be controlled or what it would look like, but it would be more scary than what it is, where at least Zhuganov is saying, you know, there'll be blood if I try to renationalize, I can't do that. And he does, as Steph was saying, have horrible people around him, and people are quite concerned. So in a sense, using privatization as a means to cause social revolution, which was the idea that Chubais and other people had, may actually have worked. And I think it's just very hard to second guess.
Could I apologize and ask our last, speaker? The question might seem irreverent, but it isn't. Thinking about Zhuganov and what he'd like to do, What's the political effect of the mafia in Russia on somebody who would like to go back and rearrange property rights and whatever?
You must remember in 1994, Boris Yeltsin made a comment that Russia is about to be run by the mafia. Yeah. Very few presidents make that type of comment.
I think it's very easy to think that, I don't know if those working, but it's very easy to think of the mafia as this sort of one block. I mean, actually, it's about thousands and thousands of different groups in Russia. Now, it's true that they're, as a mass, they have tremendous power, and there are some that are better well connected to the Yeltsin camp than others. There are some that are more a part of Yeltsin camp than others. I mean, there's certainly those cross connections with what our correspondent in Moscow calls the court businesses, where you have this sort of close connection between business, and there's obviously an overlap with that and the mafia. It's political effects of the mafia. I mean, another sort of unanswerable question. I mean, you can say in a general way, if Zhuganov gets in, then it's sort of our boys come in and the old boys go out. And to the extent that the old boys were parts of the mafia who actually did well out of certain of Yeltsin's decrees or fed off the Yeltsin power structure, then, you know, that could well have big political implications. I mean, there are a large number of people who are seriously predicting bloodshed if Zhuganov gets in, and a lot of them are serious commentators who I take seriously, even though, of course, it sounds like scaremongering. But, I mean, the mafia in itself clearly has political implications that go way beyond whether or not Zhuganov wins, right? That you have, you know, if you don't have some kind of sense of property rights, if you are a small company and you live as much in fear of the mafia, if not more, than you live in fear of regulations by government, then that has, you know, a huge effect on whether people feel safe enough to invest, whether foreigners come in. So I think, you know, the political implications and economic implications are really difficult, whatever happens in the election. But then, you know, you'd have to understand more than I do about the actual, the Byzantine, that word again, or the opaque functionings of the current political situation.
Don't let's forget that mafia is an Italian word, and in Italy, certainly in Sicily, where it began, they say la lupara fa giustizia, which means the lupara is the sawn-off shotgun, and it is the reflection of a society where individuals cannot find security from the state, and it's the product of a weak state. And what we have in Russia is the breakdown of a very powerful state and the collapse of a very powerful state, and its replacement by what exactly? Well, if you want to get your bills paid, if you don't want your shopfront knocked in and so on and so forth, you pay an insurance premium, and that insurance premium we call protection rackets or whatever, but this is a form, the mafia is actually a form of private enterprise. It is the private provision of services which the state cannot deliver.
Thank you. We started this evening on prospects for the future. I know of few subjects on a Monday evening that can keep people here to 9:37. Clearly, we all agree by voting with our bottoms that there are some prospects here. I get the general view that there is a buoyant future. There are some buts, and I think the buts require heeding, but tread warily, and one may go far. We say in our own company, go east, young person, and it's certainly worked well for my organisation. I suspect other organisations here have also found East Central Europe and the former Soviet Union, that enormous landmass, an enormously profitable, high experience and personally challenging place to be. And I thank you all for listening to us. Thank you.